Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking about the St. John's Ambulance and the story that surrounds that organization and some of the more recent events. But we're gonna try and do a deep dive into it. As always, I'm joined by my co-host Martin McMahon. Martin, are you enjoying this steady flow of sunshine we've had?
Yeah, it's very nice, isn't it? Long may it last, and I hope everybody's getting out and enjoying it a bit.
Yeah, well, I do want this plug. Last night I put out an episode of Policed with obviously Dr. Vicky Conway's host of Policed, and James Leonard of the Two Norries is the featured guest around addiction, and it's really, really, really exceptional. I've listened to it twice, and that's as someone who has actually produced it, to help produce it with Brian. It's really exceptional, so don't miss it. It's some of the best stuff I've heard on deprivation, poverty, and addiction as an escape. So I can't recommend it highly enough. So it's Policed. You'll find it all over the interweb, as they say. Anyway, we are delighted to be rejoined on the podcast by our friend and journalist with the Irish Times, Jack Power. Jack, how are you keeping?
How's it going, guys? What's the crack?
Good to see you again. It's been a little while since we spoke, but you have been busy over the last number of years, if truth be told, dealing with some of the sexual violence and sexual abuse cases, whether it be from St. John's Ambulance or Scouting Ireland, that you've continued to report them. But for the benefit of our listeners, we're going to focus on St. John's Ambulance. And again, if you're a long-time listener, you'll have heard Mick Finnegan tell his story several times. Jack is one of the key voices in getting that story amplified. Jack, could you just bring us back to when you started to cover this and maybe the story itself from the outset, and we'll prod and ask a few questions as we go, if that's okay.
Yeah. So I suppose this story started from my perspective last summer. So I got a call from somebody that said, there's this survivor of abuse that I think you should talk to. And his name is Mick Finnegan. So I got in touch with Mick, and we sat down, we met for kind of a social distance coffee in Stephen's Green, and he kind of told me his story over the course of a day. So Mick was abused as a child when he was a young cadet in St. John's Ambulance in the old Camanum division in Dublin. And so Mick was one of three alleged survivors who were taking a civil case against the organization. And I suppose none of this had ever been aired in the public or aired in the media. And I suppose what kind of really prompted us coming to the fore was TUSLA, the state child and family agency. They'd been investigating the allegations. And over a kind of a protracted process of a few years, they were investigating the allegations made by Mick and another survivor, Paul McHolland. And so TUSLA came back at the end of it and effectively said, TUSLA, when they make a determination, they either deem it founded or unfounded. So TUSLA came back and they deemed the allegations against a former senior figure in St. John's Ambulance, they deemed them to be founded. And that, I suppose, process, that determination was made in the summer of 2020. So we in the Irish Times kind of got about investigating it from there, I suppose, and just kind of tracking it back. And these allegations related to incidents in the 1990s when the perpetrator who hasn't been named was a senior figure in that old Camanum division for many decades. And he left around 2000. Shortly after Mick Finnegan had initially reported the abuse, both to internally to St. John Ambulance and to An Garda Síochána. So in August 2020, the Irish Times published a full page detailed kind of account of revealing for the first time this historical abuse in the St. John Ambulance, which is a voluntary paramedic organization. You know, most people, I'd say, would probably recognize them from their kind of first aid posts at different either sporting events or different kind of concerts and stuff like that. So I suppose initially there was, you know, kind of a lot of, I suppose, kind of shock and sympathy that this had happened, and, you know, kind of solidarity to the three men who were survivors of the perpetrator. And then what slowly happened as we kind of continued to look into the matter and investigate the matter, was more people started to come forward. So, you know, a fourth alleged survivor came forward, and he recently made a complaint to the Gardaí. A fifth survivor then got in touch with me. And I suppose along the way, there was a pressure building for a more thorough and kind of comprehensive inquiry into how this had happened and how the abuse cases, I suppose, that had been handled by the organization at the time in the 1990s. Two of the five survivors that I spoke to, have claimed that they told people at the time, they reported it at the time as they, you know, as they were kind of correct to do. And so the question remains, you know, what steps did the organization take on foot of those reports at the time? So the organization has said that it's issued statements that its current child protection policy is robust. It says, you know, it has Garda vetting and training in place for all current volunteers. But I suppose it's really kind of shied away from commenting on the historical abuse in specific terms and in detail, because it says that due to the civil cases being taken by Mick and two other survivors, that it can't comment while those legal proceedings are ongoing.
We're going to hit pause on the podcast for just a minute because we have to. These podcasts take time, effort, money, labor of love, yes, but unfortunately love doesn't pay the bills. If you enjoy what the Tortoise Shack produces, and be that any of the podcasts that we do, please consider going to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. There's a range of options there. I mean, it starts from a couple of quid, but for 550, whatever it is, there's a euro amount in there. You get a ton of extra content. You'd have been at last night's Live Glow West, and you could be at tomorrow night's Live Write the Protest podcast, because that's where all of that stuff goes, plus our regular Sunday shows and all of the other things that people come along to and enjoy. Doesn't happen without you guys. And, you know, we are growing. We took the decision to keep growing the podcast as a network. And rightly or wrongly, we pushed our cards onto the table. And the only way it works is if you put your hands in your pocket. We could do with a lot more of you helping us, if I'm being perfectly honest. And if you are on patreon.com/tortoiseshack and you're listening to our podcast, you don't have to hear me ask for this, because the podcast come out without this little interruption. So isn't that a nice little sweetener?
That is the best feature of the whole lot, Tony. So patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thanks, folks. Let's go back to your podcast now.
In specific terms and in detail, because it says that due to the civil cases being taken by Mick and two other survivors, that it can't comment while those legal proceedings are ongoing. So I suppose as this pressure was building on the organisation, you know, we saw, you know, different people like One in Four calling for, you know, kind of a more comprehensive inquiry into the matter. In the Seanad as well, Lynn Rand, the independent senator from the Trinity College panel, I suppose she really took up the baton and on two separate occasions made, you know, very passionate speeches in the Seanad, on one case calling for basically a scoping inquiry to be set up to try and get to the bottom of how the organisation handled the reports of abuse. So kind of on foot of that, Minister for Children Roderick O'Gorman met with, you know, kind of senior officials in the organisation. And following that, the organisation at the start of this year decided and announced that it was appointing Dr. Geoffrey Shannon to conduct an independent report into the past abuse, into the historical abuse, into both how it was handled and I suppose to what extent it was confined to one perpetrator, or, you know, if there were other reports against other perpetrators. So I suppose Geoffrey Shannon Most people might kind of recognize the name. He's probably one of the most preeminent kind of child protection and child law experts in the country. You know, he's led multiple different reviews into cases like a really seminal report into children in state care who died that was towards the earlier half of this century, and he's kind of involved in a lot of other reports. And I suppose his name would really carry a lot of weight. He was for decades he was the state's special rapporteur on child protection, where he would issue basically annual reports on how the state was basically how the state was doing in terms of child protection, what needed to be improved, where we were failing. So I think he was probably broadly welcomed as, you know, a really, really competent person to go in and try and get to the bottom of this, try and bottom it out. And, you know, and his work will include, you know, going through whatever records the organization have.
What's your sense of it, Jack? Is it isolated, a terrible word, isolated to that particular section? How far back does it go? Have they been forthright in dealing with it? And just your impression, Jack, I'm not looking for the you know, anything that would interfere in a civil case.
Yeah, I suppose it's hard to say, and it's one of those things that you kind of have to rely on your kind of insight from, say, previous work that I did looking into you know, historical abuse in the Boy Scouts and Scouting in Ireland. Like, I think we know when it comes to these type of perpetrators who they, you know, ingratiate themselves in these organizations that will give them access to children or vulnerable people, you know, and, you know, at times they can rise to you know, kind of, you know, senior or prominent positions in these organizations that then, I suppose, allow them to kind of somewhat weather the storm or try and, you know, rebut any kind of anything that's any complaint made against them. And so we know that in this case, this perpetrator was a member of the organization from, you know, around the 1950s up till the late 1990s, 2000. So there's a significant degree of time he spent, yes, in the organization. So that would, you know, lead you to believe that, and you know, I've the sense that there are other survivors, and there likely are other survivors out there, you know, who haven't come forward to date. And I suppose the question as well is, you know, is it confined to, you know, just one perpetrator who was acting at the time? And I suppose that's something we don't really know the extent of. And I suppose that's probably something that, you know, survivors and other people kind of hope that Jeffrey Shannon might be able to get to the bottom of in his report, with the access to interviews with people, interviews with current and former volunteers, access to records.
But Jack, the story has moved on as well. I mean, you wrote a story earlier this week, I think it was Monday, that covered events that have taken place in the UK that have an impact on this story. I don't know how much of, like, I mean, I'm not speaking out of turn. I've seen the emails. Like, I mean, maybe can you just explain a little bit about that, and maybe we might parse that a little bit?
Yeah, so the latest, I suppose, development in this story. So this started when I was looking into the organization's child protection policy. So I kind of had words kind of just through my reporting that they drafted up a child protection policy sometime in the 1990s. And one individual responsible for drafting up that policy, or definitely involved in drafting up that policy, was a guy called Larry Shannon, who's a previous kind of cadet superintendent. So he worked with the young members in Cabinteely in the 80s and the 90s. So basically through my reporting, I wanted to set about kind of finding this guy and talking to him. And in the midst of that, it kind of transpired that he had actually previously in recent years been convicted in England for attempting to groom and meet a 15-year-old child for the purposes of sexual activity. So I suppose that was a real shock. And this individual, Larry Shannon, he actually died at the start of last month. So it was kind of a serendipitous. Just as I was looking into this, I also found out in one instance that he had this conviction, which, probably would have shocked a lot of the members of St. John Ambulance, and two, that he'd actually recently died.
There was a lot of accolades from the higher echelons when he died as well, Jack. They pretty much blanked his history.
Yeah, so after, in the days after he died, this would have been early last month, the organization, its commissioner, John Hughes, sent out an email to all their members, really praising this man, Larry Shannon. He said, he was a loyal volunteer. He described him as a good friend. This individual, Shannon, he hadn't been involved with the organization for kind of a number of years, but he was, I suppose, probably regarded and really well regarded by its membership. So I think there was a certain element of the fact that the vast majority of the organization claims to have not have had any knowledge that he had this conviction in England. So around in kind of a few years ago, I think he moved to England from Wicklow. I think it was after his marriage broke down, he moved over to England. And then it was in England, he basically got caught in one of these, vigilante...
It was a sting.
Paedophile hunter stings, yeah. Where, a group kind of impersonates... in this case, a group was impersonating a 15-year-old boy on an online account. And this man, Larry Shannon, basically was messaging this account. And then when he agreed, he sent an indecent photo... Essex police told me, and then when he agreed to meet the boy, he turned up at the, or what he thought was a boy, he turned up at the meeting spot at a McDonald's, and he was arrested there, and then he was later charged with attempting to groom and meet a child under the age of 16 for sexual activity, and he pled in 2019, he pleaded guilty to that offence, and then it seems to be that. I suppose that news of that, one of the survivors, Mick, was actually the original person to unearth a media report of that court case, in a really tiny local paper. Myself and Mick, we were kind of talking, and we were saying, this couldn't be the same Larry Shannon who wrote the organization's child protection policy at the, in the 90s. Like it would be too strange a coincidence. So I basically set about trying to confirm it was the same person, because obviously you don't want to accuse the wrong individual just because they have the same name as somebody. So I basically was able to confirm his date of birth, and then contact both Essex Police and another individual that was involved in that case. And by way of that, we kind of confirmed basically that this was one and the same guy, and this had been, a former St. John Ambulance volunteer, who would have worked with young members and children in the organization for considerable periods in both the 80s and the 90s.
It's the same period that we keep referring to Mick, because in fairness to him, he is absolutely driving this. His courage to continually tell his story has been really, a testament to making it public. And also want to acknowledge Lynn Ruan made a fantastic speech and has done some great work on this. No less than yourself, so never let it be said. But at the same time, it must have been re-traumatizing to the people who have come forward to see I've seen the emails, my good colleague, my friend, our thoughts are with them, all of the platitudes that are paid to people, and no acknowledgement of the man was convicted for attempting to groom a 15-year-old child. Yeah. And given the sensitivity around it. Now, the actual investigation or the state of play into that, I know there's been... talk backwards and forwards about the scope, what's in scope, what's not, and what's saying that St. John's Ambulance will have. What's your sense in terms of I mean, you've given us the credentials of Jeffrey Shannon, and that's really positive. And I don't think anybody can deny the man has great credentials. And actually, again, kind of a little bit of credit to the minister, Roderick O'Gorman, for doing, you know, I know he's met with survivors and spoken to them as well and shown a personal interest in this. But are we confident now that St. John's Ambulance are playing ball on this with the remit and with the scope of the investigation, Jack?
Yeah, so I suppose when the terms of reference, you know, which I've gone through of the report, you know, they clearly state that, you know, it was set up to investigate, you know, allegations and the handling of allegations related to one volunteer. But the terms of reference later, you know, kind of clarify that the scope does extend to potential other allegations against other individuals. So I suppose in terms of the size of the pitch, it definitely is wider than just one, you know, former volunteer. I think St. John Ambulance, when they announced the review, a statement they put out to the press, I suppose kind of alluded to the fact that, or suggested that the fact the review was only going to be related to kind of almost confirming that they'd handled allegations in relation to one former volunteer correctly. But I would contend that the terms of reference, you know, are broader than that. And so in terms of the issue of, I suppose how much cooperation Jeffrey Shannon will get, you know, I certainly haven't heard that the organization are kind of a stonewalling or anything like that. And I think because, as we said, it's someone with such kind of decent credentials like Jeffrey Shannon, that, you know, he's been around long enough and kind of done this long enough that if the organization kind of try any tricks or try and play fast and loose or try and kind of stonewall or slow walk, like, I think he'd be very quick to kind of raise that in his report. And, you know, I think as well, the report, you know, will have to be published. You know, this can't be a report after it's done that can, you know, sit in the desk privately of.
Is there a parallel Garda investigation, Jack?
Yeah, so this is kind of one thing that, like, as I said previously, survivors like Mick reported it to the guards, you know, all the way back in 2000, and I suppose nothing ever really came of that inquiry at the time. And you can say maybe that, you know, I think we've known that the Gardaí and the DPP's, I suppose, approach to kind of sexual violence and, you know, historical sexual case, it's probably coming on a long, long way, even in the 20 years since then. So what happened on the Garda side of it, in 2015, one of the other three initial survivors, a second one, basically came forward to the guards and reported it. And then shortly after that, the third person did. So when that happened, the Gardaí effectively launched a new investigation and kind of reopened Mick's case that he'd reported in 2000. So that was basically investigated. I understand it, you know, they investigated pretty thoroughly and a file was sent to the Director of Public Prosecutions. But the decision came back to say that they wouldn't be proceeding to charge the alleged perpetrator, because they didn't have any, I suppose, corroborating witnesses, and they said though there was three survivors involved, each didn't necessarily corroborate the other's claim. So that kind of lay at the heart of why the DPP came back and said, you know, they weren't going to pursue a criminal charge in a court against this guy. And I think, like, that's often something that, and I've had this experience before dealing with a lot of survivors, that the DPP can be a bit of a black box in some cases. In, you know, a Garda file will go in and sometimes you won't really know why decisions were taken. There's not a lot of transparency in how the DPP make their decisions, and I know that can sometimes be frustrating for survivors and other people. And, you know, sometimes, like, say, for example, you know, reporting on some of the scout stuff. Like, there's examples where people have been, you know, charged and convicted in, say, 2015 and 2016. And in the course of those court cases, it emerges that, you know, a file was sent to the DPP, you know, nearly 20 years before, and nothing was progressed on it. So to answer your question, basically that was kind of where the Garda investigation almost stopped around 2017, 2018. And following the Irish Times kind of coverage of the last few months, one of the other, a new survivor, basically made a report to the guards. And so a fresh inquiry has been launched on that basis. So the guards are currently investigating it again. And as I said, that's only the survivors that, you know, I'm in touch with, and, you know, I've contacted the Irish Times and we know about. There, you know, there may well be others who have also gone to the guards that we don't know about.
Jack, again, this is really difficult topic to explore. It's child sex abuse. It's horrendous. And it's historical, so it's very difficult to prove. I'm conscious of the people who are involved, the actual people who have the courage to come forward, and the people who actually are just getting on with their lives as well. That doesn't mean they're any less brave, by the way. I just think that there's the element in this, though, within St. John's Ambulance, some of the reactions up until recently is that they had to be brought to the table in some ways to deal with this. That this is me editorializing, Jack. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but it does seem that if it wasn't for the reporting that you've continued to do over the last 12-18 months on this. I want to reference also Peter Maguire's brilliant piece, Speak and Survive, on the topic as well, was fantastic, and also included Mick's story. Can I ask you, as someone who's done this a couple of times in terms of the scouting Ireland story as well, is this the, you know, do you feel this is the stuff that pays off? This is where the value is, where it really pays off. This is a broader question about the role of media and actually helping break through those stories and getting the public to actually give a shit about something that happened, even in the recent history.
Yeah, and I think like sometimes people ask me, like, you know, how do you find it? Constantly reporting on, you know, a topic that's as heavy as, you know, as you said, you know, childhood sexual abuse, and you know, there'd be plenty of times where, you know, you could be hours on the phone to, you know, people who've, you know, suffered, you know, horrifically in the past, and they're not looking to you know, to have a story done or anything. They're just looking to talk to somebody who's, you know, kind of a listening ear. I'd always kind of say to that I've always found that it's often the most rewarding work, because you feel like you're doing something important, and you feel like, say for example, like Mick is somebody who's been, you know, trying to raise this for, you know, 20 years, so, you know, telling his story.
Can I quote him? Just I'm just reading what he said to me, because he knows we were having this conversation today, and he said, "I'm just an annoying fucker who won't go away." So,
hey, but the world needs annoying fuckers. I'd say that probably applies to me in a lot of cases as well.
Can I ask, Jack? You're, and I don't mean this in a bad way, you're a young guy, but you're dealing with these hugely difficult subjects, and they are difficult, and they do have an impact, no matter how much you think they don't. Are you receiving support on your end when you're doing this work? I mean, it's hard stuff to do in isolation. It really is difficult stuff.
Yeah, and it is tough. I think it kind of goes back to, as I was saying, that it is very rewarding when you can kind of feel that you're giving somebody kind of a voice who's felt that they haven't been listened to for, you know, for two decades or more. And then when something comes of it, like for example with the scout stuff, that like the result of, you know, the media pressure from the Irish Times you know, led to a lot more people coming forward, and in the end, you know, more than 350 past survivors of historical abuse in kind of legacy scouting organizations kind of came forward, and probably for the first time were were kind of properly heard and acknowledged. So similar to the St. John Ambulance kind of story, you know, when somebody like kind of Jeffrey Shannon was appointed to do a review, like that was a gratifying moment, because you felt that, you know, something was now being done, and that you know, people were going to be heard, and that there would be like, if there were failings in the past, that they'd be brought to light, and the organization would be held accountable for those if that's what happened.
Jack, just I've one last question. You've mentioned several people have come forward, and I know we've used two names now, and we know of other individuals, and there are other people who've come forward recently. Has there been any supports offered to the people who've come forward that you're aware of? Any kind of, you know, if we refer to them as in when we talk to people in homeless service, talk about wraparound services, whether it be dealing with previous traumas or dealing with traumas that people are going through. To your knowledge, has the organization offered anything, or has the state offered anything?
So as I understand it, I think with regard to the three individuals that are taking a civil case, it's my understanding that the St. John Ambulance has offered, I think, therapy or counselling. But there hasn't been any, I suppose there hasn't been any more wider scheme where, you know, St. John Ambulance have set up a kind of a helpline or a support line or anything like that, or any kind of funded counseling service that survivors who, you know, who aren't included in those three that are taking a civil case can kind of apply to you know, to get counseling or therapeutic support. And this was another thing in recent weeks that I think the Minister for Children, Roger O'Gorman, only I think last week wrote to the organisation about. He basically wasn't happy, and Lynn Rann raised it in the Shannon, that they weren't happy at the lack of kind of advertising and publicising of Jeffrey Shannon's review that the organisation were doing. You know, Lynn Rann basically kind of called it a silent investigation, and criticised that, you know, the organisation, they as far as I'm aware, they hadn't pushed it out to their members. They hadn't pushed it out, you know, on their social media channels to tell people that, you know, if you're affected or if you have information, this is who you can contact to kind of share your story or to share information. So I think on foot of some of that pressure, I've seen in the last few days, the organization has, you know, put out some tweets referencing the review. But that was certainly something that there had been a kind of a degree of annoyance that they'd been seen to almost set it up and just let it kind of sit there in the corner in the dark.
Jack Power, I think that's a good point to leave this. Thank you very much. And I'll just say Jack Power, Young Journalist of the Year, Irish Times.
he mentioned the Irish Times a few times. I don't know if you picked up on that.
We'll always mention the Irish Times.
No, we won't.
But I do want to say thanks, Jack. And I know for people, you know, victim is not the word I use for people who stand up and fight back and try to expose what happened to them. I use the word whistleblower. And I think to have journalists who will listen to whistleblowers, and you know, that's the key thing a whistleblower wants, is just to tell their story their way and to have somebody listen. I think you're doing a great service there. And thank you for coming on and having this chat with us, Jack.
Super, guys. Thanks.
Thanks for listening, folks. We'll be back shortly because we have Mairead Enright and Vicky Conway on what went down with the mother and baby home. How do we put this, Jack? You probably saw this. They couldn't give evidence, couldn't answer to a committee, but could talk to a university in the UK about the situation. So we have a report on that coming up this afternoon, and then Lisa Nealon of the Dublin Inquirer and Killian Woods of the Business Post will be with us on housing for a change, because, you know, we never cover housing on this podcast. Talk to you all very, very soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.